I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, I'm Ricky from Salisbury, and you're listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything. My question is, do you think cancel culture is fair? And do you think it's fair how some people, you know, they just get cancelled for sharing their opinions, even if people don't agree with them? Okay, here comes the show. Remember, question everything.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, a podcast where myself, comedian, writer, and occasional actor Dane Baptiste, my producer friend Howard Cohen, a.k.a. De Hizza,
hello,
and a mix of very special guests pose to questions that need to be asked, and we are talking everything from...
We are talking everything from Ricky from Salisbury's question. Do you think cancel culture is fair, and do you think it's fair that people should get cancelled for sharing their opinions, good or bad? Ricky... Thanks, mate. How are we supposed to do that in a minute, Dane? We've got to get the guest on.
I'll try and keep it as brief as possible because I'm the one who struggles with brevity. The first question being, do you think that cancel culture is fair? I don't think it's fair or unfair. I think cancel culture only has power over the people that believe in cancel culture. If someone tries to cancel you, you don't care who they are, they can't cancel you. So far as opinions being good or bad, I feel like the real issue is about opinions, in that you are entitled to have an opinion, but should be aware of expressing that opinion, you can have consequences for said opinion. That's why their opinions are not facts, because facts are indefensible, whereas opinions are subjective.
Well, there you go, Ricky. Take that one and put that in your cancel culture pipe and, you know, blaze it. But suffice to say, on this podcast, we ask and answer all the questions, including yours, Ricky. Hope you enjoyed that.
Absolutely. No question is too good, too bad, or too opinionated. And if you do like the show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify, and you'll never miss an episode. We can hear all of our very special questions being asked and answered by our very special guests. With that being said, on today's show is a broadcaster and journalist known best for her roles on Loose Women and The One Show. She has worked across a wealth of shows within entertainment, children, and current affairs, and has been co-starring with her mum, Mavis, on Dirty Rotten Scammers, which explores the world of cyber-enabled fraud, hacking, and other internet-led crime, fighting the good fight, both in real life and online. Please welcome to the show, Ms. Michelle Ackerley.
Hello. Thanks for having me, guys. What a lovely introduction.
Welcome. Have you been cancelled for anything that we should know about?
Not yet. Give it time. Who knows? Maybe after this podcast.
Perfect. Well, that'll get some headlines.
I mean, I'm sure someone has had the opinion you should be cancelled. But again, if you aren't willing to indulge that opinion, who cares?
I thought you said that very well, actually. You know, it's about not caring, isn't it? But sometimes we do.
Well, the issue isn't about cancel culture. The issue is about people having a sense of shame and having a sense of, I suppose, there should be a common level of decency that everybody has. But if people tend to kind of flout that, I suppose that's why we call for people to be cancelled. But really, again, you know, you can be cancelled, but it depends who you're being cancelled to. You know, there's a lot of...
I was just going to... Yeah. Where do they go? These people, when they cancel, like, where do they actually go?
Exactly. That's the point, Michelle, because, like, I've heard of, like, comedians like Jim Davidson, for example, complain about cancel culture. You've been doing this for over 25 years. So if you have... If you know you have an audience that like what you're saying, just go to them directly. In the same way that people can contact you directly on social media, on digital media, and cancel you, the people that support you can go and continue to do so. So, you know...
So true.
In this world where you can anonymously bankroll people that commit mass shootings and police officers that take innocent lives, I feel like it's not too hard to continue a career if you've been cancelled, so to speak.
I think people just like saying it now as well, like, I've been cancelled, you know, and then it's like, we're all getting on the bandwagon and feel sorry for the cancelled person. And almost that's a thing in itself now. There's another storyline kind of gearing up about what we call the cancellationers. I don't know what you'd call
it. I describe it as cancel culture.
Cancel culture is the digital equivalent of being a suicide bomber. It's just doing martyrdom because you want to get in paradise and be revered by other people that share your views. So it's just like, it's making yourself a martyr deliberately. So that's all cancel culture is really. Because it's easier to be a victim than a failure, unfortunately. And to paint yourself as a victim is much easier than saying, I made a mistake. And that's the thing. Cancel culture really is somebody, again, giving over their accountability to an external party and being like, I could have changed, but they cancelled me before I could.
People just don't like saying sorry, do they?
That's
That is a brilliant that is a brilliant version of the whole story.
It required the Mancunian Mancunian inflection as well to say people just don't like saying sorry, do they? That's the best. You put it even more succinctly than I could have done.
It is what it is.
You know what, Michelle, it's probably time for a question, as the format of this show dictates, Dane.
Absolutely, Michelle, as our very esteemed guest, we'd like to invite you to ask the first question, which can be any question you like, whether it's based in fact or opinion, which like to discuss for about 15 minutes and some change. Then Howard, my producer friend, would like to pose a question to you as well, which you'd like to discuss for the same amount of time. And keeping with tradition, I would like to pose a question to you that we discuss for about 15 minutes, and then we'd love for you to tell our listeners and viewers where they can find out about your good works, past, present and future. How does that sound?
It sounds very clear, very thorough. I understand fully.
It's a format podcast.
I know exactly where I'm up to, which is great.
Lovely.
So I'll start with my question then, after your instructions. My question to you guys is, do you think a person's success can be in part deemed by a great stage presence?
And has this been inspired, this question, by anything in particular, Michelle?
Well, the way of the world at the moment, especially with the politicians. I was watching the news recently, and Boris Johnson, former Prime Minister, did his parting speech. And as part of it, he said, you know, I have fulfilled the role and I leave now like a rocket, you know, jetting off into space. And it was, I mean, the language was like, well, this is what happened. I was watching with other people in the room and it was so interesting seeing the reactions, because some people were like, what a guy, you know, he's so confident with the way he holds himself. And it was more about his kind of fluid language and description and the way he was holding himself than actually everything that's been going on in the past 3 years, especially, let's be honest. So yeah, it's I think it's an interesting question.
Yeah,
it's a very interesting question. I mean, just thinking about Boris Johnson and, you know, kind of, I mean, does ship float? I don't know if ship floats.
Or shit does float.
Yeah, yeah, right, okay, interesting.
Just I've seen ship float.
So he floats, basically, because he's so full of shit. If you put Boris Johnson in any body of water, he will just float happily.
Yeah, or deny that he's even in water, or deny that he's a piece of shit. So, yeah.
But
the subject you're bringing up, it is fascinating, because ultimately, you know, all stage presence is, I would say, is about confidence, right?
Yes.
Like, you know, Dane on stage, a very confident man. I mean, if you counted the amount of comedy gigs you've performed in your life?
I haven't, which I always felt weird when people did that.
Yeah, I just find it funny to think that we're probably in, like, what, we're entering 5 digits potentially? I don't know. Anyway, you can go and work that out.
But I'd imagine, definitely 5 digits at this point. But yeah, again,
in the 10,000 time. So Dane's stage presence, like, no, you know, just to make it clear, it's not bullshit, right? Because he's done it 10,000 times, right?
Yeah, so he's got it down to a T.
So he should be confident, right? He should have bravado. You should be like, yeah, fuck you, I'm going to come up here and be funny. I've done it 10,000 times, right? Whereas you think about it with, like, these politicians, right, where ultimately they don't have anything to really back up what they're getting up there to say. Because, I mean, if anyone can tell, listeners, please write in and tell us things that politicians have done that have been good or right or correct, because I'm going to struggle to think of any.
It's so tricky. I was listening to Liz Truss's, would you call it an acceptance speech? I don't know, when you get kind of
You could argue that, because politics is basically celebrity for ugly people. That's what people used to say, that politics is for people too ugly to be celebrities. So we can call it an acceptance speech. And considering that that her vote was put down to a panel as opposed to actually her being democratically elected, I'd say, it was an acceptance speech.
Yeah, it's a fair description. As part of her speech, she was saying, I don't know whether she'd just kind of forgotten what she wanted to talk about, because she said, we can deliver. But then she paused and she said it about three or four more times. You know, I mean, I've done that when I'm just trying to get my words together, think, what am I saying next here? And she's just like, we can deliver, we can deliver, we can deliver. It's like a stuck record. I'm thinking, this isn't great stage presence to me, Liz. I don't know that much about you, but your stage presence is lacking here. I've heard your first sentence.
I mean, from your description,
we can deliver. Yeah. I don't need to hear it again.
Sounds like
again,
you might be a fucking
again.
Robot, Michelle, potentially, which is worrying, because AI is if one thing's doing well at the moment, it's AI, right? They're going places. If you wanted to vote for a party at the moment, the AI party is looking pretty appealing.
I mean, it's the way
more reliable.
It's the way it's going to go eventually, anyway. Yeah. And but obviously, politics is very different to how the binary nature of algorithms. But because they work in zeros and ones, and politics is pretty much people just talking within a grey area.
But give it another 20 years, and there'll be like an Agent Smith, like of the Matrix kind of character, that's presented to us by the robots as a new leader.
I mean, we say this, but I think we're already at a point now where bots already say stuff to support the things that people say,
of course,
and add to that confidence and stage presence, even though what they says has no factual basis. Because it's very easy to pick up on like the existence of a bot, where whatever Boris Johnson does, there'll always be a few people whose profiles always incidentally have either a picture of a knight from the Crusades and an Israeli flag and an American flag and an English flag, and they're like, I back Boris. Or even when back Boris trended online, and then when you actually looked at the trend, the nature of the tweets, like most of the people that were saying I back Boris had never tweeted anything else in their entire life, and had all mysteriously joined Twitter 3 months ago. So
it's very strange, that, isn't it?
It's very strange. So I think the point about AI being assisting in political affairs, we're definitely past the point. But I think, so far as the stage presence, I agree with Howard. I think a large part of it comes to confidence, and I think a lot of that confidence, particularly when we're talking about people in the political class, stems from elitism and the kind of environments that they are brought up in or are allowed to thrive in. So in Boris Johnson's case, being someone who's maybe, is he Etonian educated? Being Etonian educated, as well as being a member of the Bullingdon Club, I think it is a part and parcel that it is, you are inculcated with a sense of superiority with the people that you speak to. And I think that goes all the way back to like feudal times, where we had a much clearer or explicit hierarchical social structure, where you would have like your nobles, and then you'd have vassals, and then you'd have your peasantry. And I think that's gone on for so long that it's become a learned behavior, particularly amongst human beings, that when someone takes a stage, we presume that they have a level of intellectual or moral superiority. That's why preachers, even though, you know, Christian doctrine is supposed to be kind of socialist in nature, like we're all the same, preachers always speak from a pulpit, which is like an elevated place in the church, which is in a place which is finely crafted and looking down on everybody else. So a lot of time, if you are addressed from high up, you know, even when we look at like even how biblical scriptures, how, you know, biblical doctrine has been described in the Bible itself, is like from on high. The idea is that someone is speaking from an elevated position. So it becomes a learned behavior that if we have to look after somebody, literally, just as we use the turn of phrase, we believe what they say. And I think people like Boris Johnson are brought up in an environment where they already approach these spaces with a sense of superiority. And also, I think it's a part of training that there's certain languages used. So I think some people may have natural stage presence and they're able to thrive in that space. But I think particularly in the case of politicians, there is a level of training where most politicians will pick their occupation first before they pick the party they'll be a member of. Liz Truss being an example of that, because she was initially a Liberal Democrat and is she's also the child of both a professor and someone who has campaigned for to reduce nuclear proliferation, only to go on to exploit in an opportunity where she can be the Prime Minister. And you go from being aligned with Liberal Democrat ideology to now being like, yeah, I'll shoot nukes if I need to. I'll tax corporations even less. We will deliver. Now, the deliver part is, I think, a part of that programming, which is called it's neuro-linguistic programming, where when someone is being trained to be a public orator, they tend to repeat words so that people associate those words with them. So even though she's not spoken on any policies or really has no plan or strategy to affect any positive policies or progressive policies for Britain, she just keeps saying deliver. So most Britons think, you just begin to make a synaptic link between Liz Truss will deliver. And she doesn't necessarily have to keep it, it keeps it very ambivalent.
I mean, it's a great choice of name, isn't it? Truss. Because you're one letter away from trust, right?
Yeah, but trust. Yeah, but you can trust things. You can trust people when you know their nature. So I trust that she will fuck it up.
Oh, of course.
Beyond
but
beyond
the average
belief.
Person out there is like, oh look, she's trustworthy. She's pretty much called Trust,
and that's
isn't
the,
she?
And that's the thing is that like it's a lot of the time people are trained to speak to particular people and use what we call dog whistles or use neurolinguistic programming. Mm. Like even a lot of comedians do it as well. Like, oh, I find a lot, there's a lot of comics who they'll preface a sentence or an anecdote by saying, and then the funniest thing happened, which I've always taken offense to because I feel like we'll be the judge of whether or not it's the funniest thing that happened.
Yeah.
You know? So,
it is fascinating, though, isn't it? It's the psychology of it all. And obviously, this is, you know, a big thing with politicians, but I even find that in the world of presenting when you distill it down. And you were saying with comedy, I've noticed that people can feel a lot more at ease the more you use their name, you know. And it's interesting because I'm from Manchester, born and bred in Manchester. My mum's a Mancunian. We just do that naturally as Northerners. It's like, you'll never guess what, Mavis. And it's just, and there is that kind of connection.
It's also very working. It's also working class, is like a working class sensibility to refer to somebody by name. It's really more of an elitist thing that you preface somebody's either their occupation or their status. So that's why, like, you know, with members of royalty or monarchs, you have to use your highness or your majesty. Politicians, well, I mean, a doctor, you would say a doctor or a professor. So it's because of elitism that we tend to preface somebody with their title. It's only really amongst the laity that we would just use the normal honorifics of either saying someone's name or saying like mate or love or buddy or brethren. Like, these are honorifics that we've created ourselves. And I think that politics have picked up on that and are now using the same techniques, which is why we've seen such an increase in populism, where politicians now, or the people that we now appoint as leaders now, don't really have anything to say or don't really use politics or use political language. What they do instead is that it's a lot of rabble-rousing, where, you know, you'll have someone like Donald Trump being like, we'll bring back coal. Or, you know...
But when you look at what...
Liz Truss being like, I'm going to bring back cheese.
I love pork pie
because she realizes these are all buzzwords and dog whistles that tend to endear her to the politically mobile and also people who may not necessarily be politically astute, but they're aware of stuff like, well, if my beer's going to be cheaper, you know, people who are lower on the hierarchy of Maslow's needs, like, you know, homes, no immigration, like none of these things have real substance to them as policies. What they tend to do instead is that it can just engage certain people. So I think, with the whole thing about stage presence, I think part of it is people naturally maybe either being able to have a high level of emotional intelligence and rapport build very quickly with an audience they're addressing, and that's something you learn through experience, like I've had to learn through comedy and how to bring people on side or relax
them. Michelle, you know, and you mentioned Loose Women, right? You know, which is, you know, I talk about kind of having stage presence and like, it's almost like a weird, you know, not to compare it to politicians, but it's a weird thing, something like Loose Women, because your audience trust you guys, you know? And when new people come onto the show, they're going to go win the trust of the audience, right, as well as the people they do it with. And it's, you know, you've got to have some stage presence to be on that show, eh?
It's a funny one with me, because I think, you know, I've presented for many years now, but I still wouldn't necessarily describe myself as somebody that has a lot of stage presence. I feel like I'm quite good at connecting with people one-on-one, but on that kind of stage, which, as you say, like Loose Women live television programs are that stage. If I get too much into my head, I can be like, oh my God. And that's why I do find it fascinating when you look at politicians, as you said, there's a separate reason why they are who they are and they do what they do. But I almost wish I could just pop into their brain for a day and just experience what it is like to be in that sphere. Maybe there's some kind of positive nugget I can take out of that and pop it into my actual real life brain and then use it, within my world.
What I would say, Michelle, is the likelihood if you spent that day is that you would come out going, I am fucking glad I don't have anything to do with that world.
Because
I tell you why, and this isn't me defending them. Yeah. I'm just making that clear to you, Dan, in case you think I'm defending the politicians. We've watched across all media, pretty much, the corruption of people in positions of power come out again and again and again. I mean, that list, I won't start doing a list, but we know where that list begins and where it ends, right? Imagine, you know, they intoxicated people. People can be intoxicated with the power they had in media, you know, and did horrible things with it. Look at what, fuck me, the politicians. I mean, it's just that on another scale. Like another level.
Well, I mean, that's partly their job anyway. The thing is about when we talk about politics and politicians, I think it kind of becomes quite problematic because we tend to, the problem is that we create this compartmentalization of these people and these institutions. And by doing that, I think we can give over too much power to them, which allows them to avoid a certain level of human accountability.
Sounds like communism to me there, Dane. Don't you know that, mate?
Yeah. It does sound like communism, but the thing is, it does. But then at the same time, it's like the idea that one, but then, you know, it also looks like communism when you have to bail out banks or when your government gives money to people to make PPE, when it's like, really, should this even be monetized in the first place if we need to make people survive a global pandemic?
Yeah.
So for me, I just think, it's in terms of their mind and how the stage presence is, I think a large part of that is the state of being that they're in. The presence is more about the presence in their mind. And I think for politicians, I think stage presence is a good point because I think they see the whole thing as a stage presentation. It's essentially a pitch. And so all they are doing is doing a sales pitch to bring people on side. It's just that, unfortunately, it's a battle for human consciousness.
Yeah, well said, mate. Yeah, well said.
And what you touched on earlier about emotional intelligence, I think, is really interesting as well, because I've noticed, especially over the last few years, more and more politicians are trying to weave into that magazine daytime world. You'll see them on Loose Women, you'll see them on This Morning, they've been on Good Morning Britain, you know, they'll be on those conversational platforms where actually it is less to do with having that typical stage presence of giving a speech to, you know, a real audience, and it's more, let me tell you a bit more about my family and my kids and my background, all those ways that soften. We relate, that softens it. And it actually is quite dangerous and scary because, as you were saying before, Dane, it's got all this political heavyweight bollocks behind it. It's veiled in such a palatable way for us all that suddenly, I mean, I've had it when I've interviewed people and I've said, you know, when they were going through the last race between Rishi and Liz, what do you think of the two policies and who, I mean, it's Conservative Party, so it's not really much change in policy, but who, if you could vote, who would you be going for? And one person I spoke to said, well, I've seen Rishi on the TV quite a bit and, you know, he seems like a nice guy. I watched him, you know, he was having an interview the other day and he was just really relaxed and chill. So I feel like I know a bit more about him, actually. So I'd probably go for him. And if that's the way, do you know what I mean? So it just feeds into that.
And that's the thing, because our consumption, or I guess the presentation of politics as it exists now is more about populism. I mean, now because we've seen with the biggest hegemony in the world in America having 4 years of a populist president who really doesn't represent either side other than his own, people have seen how effective that can be and how much that works. And now media has fallen suit where, like, before you'd be able to plot where news stations kind of sat on the bipartisan political spectrum. But they've moved now where now you have news stations that are more dedicated to populism and more sensationalism. And I guess we're now more in an era of more propaganda than we are in an era of, like, political discourse. And so,
we'll be back after this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back to the show.
Well, we're going to have to move on because we could talk about that one all day. But it's probably time for another question. But Michelle, big respect for a good question, right?
Great, then. Great question.
Yeah, you nailed it, Michelle.
Cheers, guys.
Yeah. Thanks. Feel free to put that on your...
Why couldn't you have been the Tory leader, for fuck's sake? Don't say you're not qualified, no. Michelle.
Did let us down.
Don't no say way. You're not qualified.
Now, Michelle, my
we
question...
We will deliver. Times three. Yeah. Rule of three, isn't
we
it?
We will deliver, free ice cream on Thursdays. We deliver it to your house. That's the one policy. But I know you lactose, Dane, but let's not go down there. Okay, my question, Michelle, I very much enjoyed hearing about you when we were introduced earlier. And you're, one of the things you've been working on is a project with your mother, right?
Yes.
Do you want to just tell the audience a little bit about that show, just so they are up to date?
Sure. Yeah, so it's a programme on BBC One. It's called Dirty Rotten Scammers. And essentially, it's about Mum and I speaking to loads of people of all different ages who have been scammed, right? And it could be an email that's been sent that they think is from their bank, saying, you know, there's been fraudulent activity on your account. Get in touch with us, we'll sort it out. Next minute, they've got various bits of your information that they shouldn't have. They're taking money from your bank. And people have been defrauded from £500 to £500,000. And Mum and I basically have a really kind of open and honest conversation with people about their online digital footprint. So they might not actually know that they've been in various data breaches and their passwords have been leaked online. And we kind of present to them exactly what is out there on them. So their passwords that might be involved in a data breach or whatever.
And how many episodes of this show have you done out of interest? Kind of?
We did 15 episodes, 15 45-minute episodes.
And so I know you must have spent a significant amount of time with your mother to make that program.
I did. I'm in my mum's house right now.
Right. I'm going to ask this question without knowing intimately about the relationship with your mother, but I can tell you from my perspective, if they want to make a fucking TV show of me and my mum, I ain't even getting to the pilot.
I put it in my contracts that my mother can't even be on set.
How can you cope?
Part of your rider.
Basically.
How can you cope with spending so much? How does one, let's make it nice and general. How does one cope with spending time with their mothers?
Professionally.
Well, and just generally as well, because it feels like a job at times.
It's an interesting question. I mean, Mum and I have always been very close. And we'd done bits and pieces together on telly before, so we've kind of understood what our dynamic is. This was very different, right? Because it was all filmed in Manchester. So we were filming together, staying together, waking up in the morning, going for breakfast together, and then doing it all over again. I'm not going to lie. It was intense.
That's very, very diplomatically put.
It was intense. But you know what was really interesting? I was able to see my mum from like a different point of view. You know what it's kind of like in the media? You work with so many different people and some have bigger egos or less manageable egos than others. For me, it was actually quite refreshing working with someone that I know really well anyway. So I know we might have a bust up and we might have an argument. She might tell me to piss off and I might say the same to her. But I know where I'm up to. If I'm going to tell
it's a bit different to you, Michelle. You'll say it under your breath.
You
piss off and leave me alone, lady. What was that, Michelle? I said, I'm going.
I love my mother, right? I'd probably say more than, well, she's definitely in the top couple of people in the world, right? She's brilliant. She drives me up the fucking wall. At a level I can't describe. Now, Dave, you know, I've noticed...
Don't push me under this bus too hard.
No, I want to talk about your sister. I know your sister, you got, you know, I'm sure you're good, but, you know, there was a dynamic when I saw you guys together. I was like, she definitely irritates this man. She irritates him. That's fine, but I think if I was twins, you know, okay, fine.
Yeah.
But my mum, she can turn up at my house and within the space of, like, 3 minutes, I'm already like, okay, Mum, I'm just going to go in the next room. As you're saying. And like, I'm not that. I'm quite a tolerant guy. I mean, I work with a lot of comedians, so it comes with the territory, you know. So it's like I'm not, but she can just Just like
it is, there is something with mums though that can do that. Like I came to stay with my mum last night, and it's something that you can almost feel in your stomach, like, oh,
yeah.
And it just makes me regress to like being a 10-year-old kid, because I'm like, what is it? What is it that you're doing? It's some kind of mystical power that's making me like, oh God, mum, yeah. Oh God. Yeah. But my mum is such a talker as well that it was quite refreshing in a way working with her, because I could just chill out for a bit. Well, you know, she's like, the contributors would come in and she's just like, bam. As soon as new people come into the room, she is on and doesn't stop. But then it's funny because at the end of the day, she'd be like, you know what, Michelle? I'm knackered. I'm so tired. I'm like, yeah, mum. So, you know, when I finish work and then I come and see you and you're literally on. Yeah. Welcome to my world. This is how I'm feeling.
And she was like, she said, Michelle, I don't think I'm that bad. You know, it's very different when I do it. And then you were like,
okay, well.
But the thing about mums as well, and I don't want to make it a gender thing, but it is, you know, there's very different characteristics in mums and dads, I think. And, you know, with my mum, like, her obsession with my happiness, my family's happiness, with my brother's happiness, everyone's happiness, it sends me fucking mad, mate. So, like, you know, honestly, it genuinely fucks
me off.
Your
mum's what? Just too nice?
Just too much love. Too much love, mum. Just fucking pack it in.
There is such a thing.
You know what I mean? And it's like, a scenario up in the other week. Where I've talked to Dane about this, but you know, my son escaped from his cot. We probably should deal with that on another episode. But like, it was a big thing, right? And I ended up having a couple of nights, Michelle, where you know what, like, I was on like 2 or 3 hours sleep and 2 hours, right? And my mum the next morning when she called me up, she was just like, almost like someone had fucking died. Like, and I was just like, just pack it. Like, it's all right.
Oh, because you didn't get a lot of sleep?
Yeah, but it was because there was a problem with the boy. And it's like, it's fine. We'll just deal with these things. Just deal with life's problems, right? But because the love from her is so intense, like, so much love to give, that she just, that's what happens to, I think, a lot of mums. Like, I don't think that's unfair to say. Dads can do that. But mums have it at another level.
It's also fear as well, Howard, because your dad passed away quite young.
Mm.
So your mother is probably even is much that. More anxious and neurotic about the welfare.
I mean, he was like that when he was alive.
Any
to be
man,
fair.
Yeah, I know. But now he's no longer here to take the brunt. He's not here to take the brunt anymore. The closest semblance of him that's left is his progeny. So she'll overdo it.
I'm a grown man with children. And she's still buying me pants for Christmas. Do you know what I mean?
I love how you've just admitted to that.
I'll be honest, I'm wearing them now.
Yeah.
But I don't buy pants because of it.
You love it, but you hate it at the same time.
And there's
bits
that you love.
Kind of like that.
Yeah.
It's a thin line. And I think when I ponder it rationally, I do understand where it comes from. And I suppose, you know, it's the mark of a very responsible caregiver or a guardian, isn't it? That they are... cannot stop until they feel that you have the best tools that will adapt you to living in the world. And there might be something biological to that as well as psychological. That is like the best chance my offspring has of navigating this world, and the better chance I give them, the better they'll be. But then I suppose, I think that's part of it. I think it's also purpose as well. I think, you know, when you raise children and then your children go on to have children as well, you can worry that your role might become quite obsolete. So you'll try to hold on to that as much as possible.
Yeah.
The thing is, I understand it. It's just my mother doesn't listen to me, so I understand where she's coming. I understand where she's coming from, but it's just like you know, if you listen to me, you'd know what I was saying. But it's
she just doesn't
listen to me. I definitely see where Howard comes from, and I think that was the main thing I had to do with my mum when I was much younger. But I think the main frustration I have with my mother, I've had with my mum, is just I just don't think she listens to me. I think if she listened, she'd. Understand, I probably know a lot more than she thinks I do.
And also, one more thing before we move on to Dane's question, which is, Mum, I'm not tech support. Do you hear me? I'm not here to solve all of the things that go wrong with the technology. I'm not. It's just not my job. Okay, I've got kids. I've got a job. I'm doing a podcast.
You've got a life, but you are wearing her pants.
But I'm fine. Well, I'm wearing her pants, but you know what? I'm not here to solve every problem that's on WhatsApp for you. Yeah. I can't do it, Dave.
You can't do it, but you're going to have to. Because
you will do it.
I know how to solve that thing, Mum. It's fine.
At one point, you were completely helpless.
Just something in notifications.
You had to depend on a mum, and so now you've got to do tech support for
you give it back
until your son's old enough, and then you make him do it. That's how it works.
No, really good point.
This is how it passes along.
Yeah.
one last thing that really annoys me, and my mum says it all the time. She always says, to cut a long story short, the story is never, ever short. Right. I've never heard a short story.
She's never
been
short. She's never done a short one.
That's never.
A short story is called a sentence, Mum. It's a sentence. Yeah. A short story is a sentence or a paragraph, Mother. When it goes over a paragraph, then it's a story. And stories aren't short.
This is it. I just need to set you on. She knows. This is it. I think she knows because she says it when she's just gearing up for a long story. She's like, I'll just put this in at the start and then she might think it's going to be short. I know.
Yeah,
it's been going on for a very long time.
You said it's a short story. What you're describing is a pilot episode from a box set. That's not a short story. It's still a significant story arc there, Mother.
My mum's one is when she's not sure about something, she's a bit concerned about it. She'll be like, yeah, we'll see. We'll see. Yeah, we'll fucking see, Mum. Don't you worry about that. I can promise you, we'll see.
It sounds nice that you both have like little junctures in which you can actually speak. Because it sounds like at some point that there was punctuation or a full stop where you could say it more stuff. I don't have that. Which means I know a lot about my family and my ancestors and a lot of my family tree. I'm very well versed in it. But where I sit in all of that or my opinion, no one has any idea. But
Do you ever get that moment where you can just get in there, or do you get to a point where it's been going on so long, someone else speaking, that you just think, I can't even be bothered now, even if they stop speaking, I can't be asked?
That's normally what happens, is that I get to the point where I'm at the point where this, my rebuttal was relevant. We passed that point three paragraphs ago. So
let's just dovetail it
and be like, deliver. Deliver.
We're going to end this on a nice note and say, because we all mean this, I'm sure. Love you, Mum. You know, you love your mum, don't you, Michelle?
Love you, Mum.
Yeah, yeah. Dame, absolutely. Come on, mate.
No, I do love my mother, but that's why I'm like,
don't give you a buck. No buck. We're doing the nice bit because we just criticised him for 15 minutes.
I mean, I just said she doesn't listen, but yeah, and she.
No, she can listen to this.
I bet she don't. Right. That's why I'm safe. But if you just
well,
in case,
happens, you know, so, on, oh yeah,
or somebody snitches, I do love you, Mum, as you know.
Good. Dane, stop your question, mate. We've gone through a lot today already. Where are we going to next?
I think I'd just like to bring it back to Michelle again. As our very esteemed guest, who's had a very impressive and extensive and varied career as a presenter. So to keep it quite simple and ask you, if you were to present a format or a vehicle, doesn't matter if it's still in existence or fictional, what would be your favourite show to present?
Favourite show to present? I really enjoy live. I enjoy live shows because you are so in the moment. Well, I feel like I'm so in that present moment. I can't be thinking about whether I've left the dishwasher on, what I'm doing that evening, and be stressing about all different kinds of things. I used to present Crimewatch Roadshow. So that was live in a different location every day. And so my role on that was to like almost like go under the bonnet of the emergency services. So I'd be with the RNLI or the Mountain Rescue Team or with the riot police in Gravesend in Kent. And I'd basically just be in every different type of helmet, and they'd have me abseiling from the Brecon Beacons live with the Mountain Rescue Team, or being capsized in a boat with the RNLI.
They
petrol bombed me once. Like, are they trying to get rid of me? They're literally trying to drown me, throw me off a cliff, and then petrol bomb me. But it was amazing.
Or make more work for themselves, I guess, just trying to keep their own jobs going. <aren't?
laughs> That's it. But I really enjoyed that show. One, as I say, because of live and being in the moment. Two, just getting the opportunity to really understand other people, their lives, their livelihoods, why they do what they do. So I'd love to do more of that. We're based in a studio with Crimewatch now, but one thing that...
That was a very diplomatic answer there, by the way, Michelle. You could have just gone I want to host the Oscars. You know, that would have been... You could have gone there, but...
I don't know if I do, you know.
Don't fancy it.
I wouldn't want to do the Oscars anymore.
I mean, it's pretty
either.
Violent nowadays, so you're going to have to
don't want to get slapped.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And not just get slapped, have people give a standing ovation to the person that slapped you.
Yeah.
So, I definitely wouldn't want to do the Oscars. I'd just say, fuck the Oscars, man.
It's not for me.
No.
But also, Mum and I, so my grandfather's Ghanaian, and I've just got so many family members in Ghana, and I'm embarrassed to say I've never been.
Right.
I'm kind of going through this phase at the moment of being mixed heritage and not feeling like I know enough about one side of my family. My grandfather's getting old now. He's not very well. And it just, regardless, aside from TV, it's something that I want to do, just kind of discover my own identity a bit more, understand a bit more about me, but also my how it's changed from my mum's generation and my granddad's generation. When he first came to the UK, God, over, what, 70 years ago now, and he married a white woman, the two of them are kind of almost ostracised from, you know, community, and they had mixed race kids, and mum talked so openly about their experience growing up in Manchester at the time, which where racism was rife, and we've got such a, like, there's so much within our family history and things that I just want to know more about, and I feel like I kind of owe it to my family and to myself and to just know more about your culture and your heritage. So that's, you know, understand, I talk about understanding people more, that comes with me understanding myself more as well, and to be able to talk openly on a platform about that's important too, I think.
This sounds like a great show already. Is this a show? Is this a show that's a thing already?
It's not a thing. It's something, you know what it's like in telly day.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're pitching things all the time, so.
How is this not a thing already? Yourself, Colin Jackson, Rochelle Humes. They're like, the list is endless of people of dual heritage who'd want to be able to look at both sides. My friend Howard's a producer, by the way.
He's worth me mentioning.
Howard's also a producer.
You might already be talking to people about it. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's a great show.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys. You know what it's like. You go do the rounds and it's like, and then it's like, no, sorry, it's just not what we're looking for. And it's kind of, it's hard to fit in someone's box when it's actually your life. You can't just jazz it and... I mean, there's different formats you can put for something, but it is your life is what your life is, isn't it?
But it's not Gladiators then. That wasn't...
apparently that's coming back.
Fun.
Gladiators is coming back.
Gladiators is coming back.
To me, that was the most exciting. John Fashanu.
Oh, my God, that was
Gladiators.
Amazing.
It was amazing.
Apart from, which is not just a Gladiators thing, but it was basically an 80s thing, when the first attempts at diversity was like you always had to make... an adjectival, a name
racism,
for a black person, so they had to be called Shadow or Nightshade or Rhino or Saracen or Panther.
And, Panther, I was just going to say Panther.
Or like in Top Gun, you had Maverick and Iceman, and then the black guy was called Sundown. I think when it comes
we'll be
back,
watching the names.
If you do present it, Michelle, like, and if they're like, and then it's gonna be Shade, you could just be like.
No.
Yeah. Raisin. Our favourite Somali.
Why?
Our Somali private. Ransom. That's very distasteful.
Who's getting cancelled tonight?
Yeah, who's one of the lady gladiators? Treacle. Treacle, because she's sweet and dark and deadly, and things can get sticky with Treacle.
Damara.
Our Mauritian superstar. Yeah, it could get... Let's hope they definitely have meetings about that first.
Oh, we look forward to that. I mean, I did used to love Fashion New Hosting. I mean, to me, and this is niche listeners, Dane, but like the greatest performance of a TV presenter in the history of television, at least British television, very different world in America, is the nightclub comedian Les Dawson, who many listeners may not know who I'm talking about. The guy, if you go and look him up, this guy, he looked old in the 80s, so he'd been around a long time. And he hosted a show called Blankety Blank, right? Where basically, I mean, it was just, Blankety Blank's actually come back recently. Alan Carr has done a good job. And it's a show where basically you're playing, the contestant's playing, and you're going to base your winnings on whether or not the celebrities know the answers to the questions. Quite a simple premise. But by putting Les Dawson in that show, it was like he basically, every time he went over to the celebrity, he looked so fucked off because he knew that they were going to fuck it up every single time. And because he was like a, you know, he was a northern, smoking, kind of like, that kind of guy. It seemed so out of place. So out of place to see him on Saturday night television. Like, he'd been on like, you know, like ITV, you know, 11 p.m.,
Friday night, you'd have been like, oh, this is a bit edgy.
Like what,
the late show.
Late darts coverage.
Yeah, like late darts night.
Yeah.
Bullseye. Like looking at Bullseye now and Jim Bowen, you kind of go, well, that's weird, isn't it? But I guess darts was really big for a period of time. Jim Bowen was the kind of right guy. So to put, yeah, it just feels like to me, Les Dawson in that scenario is the craziest thing I ever saw. And, you know, that one of the most memorable TV presenting things. Because I think it is fair to say, and this isn't being critical to TV presenters, but sometimes it's a bit, oh, it's generic TV presenting moment. Sometimes they don't have the character they may well have, right? That it was tons of character in Les Dawson. Fucking hell.
It is getting those characters. And it's interesting how, you know, we're so focused on reality TV now. Even within reality TV, it's almost like another phase of bland because we know what to expect when we watch a Love Island or, you know, well, the Big Brother's coming back. That'll be interesting, won't it?
It won't. No, it won't. No, thank you for mentioning it.
But it'll be interesting to see how uninteresting it is because they had some previous winners on This Morning. And I can't remember
any of their names? No, neither can we.
I know one. Kate Lawler, she was the winner.
Kate Lawler.
She was cool.
Was it Chantel or Chanel?
Oh.
She was the one that went into the celebrity one.
Yes, I know.
She had to pretend she was a pop star.
It was Chantel.
I think she was called Chantel Hayes.
Because she ended up going out with the dude from the band, didn't he?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, Preston.
Yeah. Preston, yeah.
That was it. Mm-hmm. And then there was another guy, I think he was on the main series, a Geordie guy, and he was saying, when Big Brother comes back, they need to mix it up in the sense that they need Frank, who works in the local chippy in Middlesbrough, to go in. And it's not about the concept of how we make ourselves famous from a reality TV, you know, programme, how many Insta followers we're going to have and what campaign we're going to do with Boohoo or Pretty Little Thing or whatever else. It's like, you know, going back. I don't know how we create
that's the problem, how we can go back, because once the format is in the hands of business, then obviously they're going to have different stakeholders. So like Big Brother was good because it started off as like kind of like a psychological experiment of how people would be.
Exactly.
Like, but then what happened was when it had higher ratings, then it becomes ratings led. And what most executives think is that the shittier the people are, the more people will like even hate watch them and get more ratings, which means we can then attract the advertisers like Boohoo and Misguided, who then in turn will give these said reality stars these kind of deals. And so, you know, because I mean, I was surprised when I found out that like, Love Island has been going on for years and no one cared.
Yeah.
And then I guess somebody was like, why don't we make it look like porn, but with just a dialogue? And then they just started recruiting like either out of work pageant girls or like personal trainers to be on the show instead a lot of the time. And yeah, and then these people won't turn it down either, because if you are told that you can either go continue to work in a retail job in a satellite town in the UK, or you can be best poised for an opportunity to make a six-figure salary, you're not really going to say no, especially now where a cost of living crisis, so it can be quite difficult.
Exactly.
Because Big Brother is almost like the inception of reality shows. And then from the sensationalism of them, because it was like The Apprentice initially was for people that wanted to become interns or maybe start their own business, like people like Tim Campbell. And then it became for Then it became for idiots who you'd punch in the face in a normal open plan for office anyway. So
can't write a CV. Don't even know what a CV is.
Yeah.
It's like
it's the worst of the worst. Like if you want to know what's wrong with British industry, then just watch The Apprentice and see these fucking morons with no transferable skills whatsoever. Basically, take the hot potato that is accountability and pass it around each other for a whole episode. Like,
hey, but Dane, they've got great stage presence, mate. Am I right?
That's the thing.
They're so confident.
That's the thing, is the confidence in their stupidity that we all like, this is going to be such a good car crash. Yeah. I mean, and that's just, some people like hosting that. So you could present that as well.
Yeah. But I always think this, because I used to work in production before presenting, and, you know, talking about confidence and stage presence, you know, you go to so many pitching meetings as well within that world. And it takes someone to just almost have the confidence and vision to make that clean break. And when we talk about confidence, as we were saying before, have the knowledge behind them, know what they're talking about and be like, right, we don't, obviously it's a business. We all need to earn money, but this is where we can make a change. This is, let's separate what we have been doing for what we can do. Let me entice you with this new idea that's going back to this or introducing this. And it's just, you know, but
that's the problem with
it. We will get to that point.
That's the thing. The problem is nowadays is that I think I said the powers that be are now aware that they can achieve the same kind of, if nothing else, quantitative results. Like they can get ratings or they can get retweets or they can get popularity in that respect.
Yeah.
If they are able to have this populist narrative, which is only just to engage people and not, in the same way that, you know, influencers nowadays, like before, influencers, well, they have the position now that used to be the position of the artist or the creative. And what would happen is if you were good at something, then a byproduct of that would be you would get some notoriety or some profile, and you'd also be able to make money from your talent. And obviously, powers that be recognize that that's fine, but if someone is a creative, they're going to have a certain level of discernment, and they may talk about what they want or how they want their aesthetic to be realized. Whereas now you have influencers who, just like celebs now, like a celebrity used to be a byproduct of you became famous because you were good at something. And they took that and they distilled it and took the celebrity part, where you can just be famous for the sake of being famous. Now, the thing about being famous for the sake of being famous means that someone could take that away from you. And so it means you'll probably do whatever to maintain your level of profile, because you can't fall back on like a talent. And influencer has extended on that even more, whereby if you have a democratic space of opinions like social media, where anyone can say what they want, and which includes the risk of cancellation of good or bad opinions, it means that people can provide a rebuttal and also can have open dialogue with people they wouldn't normally have it, like with politicians, which is probably why now you've seen the proliferation of influencers, because they don't really influence anything that has any actual impact. And they've and it's very clear that they've been put in that position for a reason, whereby they, most influencers nowadays, like, can you think of anything they influence other than purchases?
No, well, the influencers are being influenced by the big businesses. Well, it's the other way around.
They're just human billboards. That's how an influencer works now. Is that now you, especially because if you look like somebody who comes from a more modest background that doesn't have a distinct talent, and you get to realize a certain level of fortune, it's much easier for people to project their ambition onto you, because it's like, well, if you can become famous and get it, like, imagine you've never done exercise your whole life and you do a reality show, now you've got a fitness DVD. Now, you don't actually do any exercise, you probably get a personal trainer or you use Photoshop, and then people go, well, if that person who comes from the same humble background as I can do it, so it's much easier. So again, it's like, it does go back to kind of the how you're able to, so it's more how it's presented to people nowadays is the more relatable someone is. But the problem is that the level of relativity always comes from mediocrity.
Well, we've covered an incredible amount in today's episode, Dane. I mean, that's been a...
It's been a big presentation.
A big presentation, and Michelle has been at the heart and centre of that presentation.
And Mum too, if she's around. I'm sure she can hear.
she's not here. She's not actually in the room, but which is a surprise.
She'll know, and when she looks back... She'll know that I was on her side, so that's how that works.
Thank you for coming on the show, Michelle. You've been a great guest.
Absolutely, Michelle.
I've loved it.
It's been a real pleasure. Please let our listeners know where they can find out where you are at the moment, where you'll be, and where you've been, and what they should look for.
Gosh, well, in all of October, I will be hosting Crimewatch Live in Cardiff. But you can follow me on Instagram. Just search my name, Michelle Ackley, and I will pop up. And yeah, keep you abreast of everything on Twitter as well, at Mish Ackley.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, we'll do that now then.
Yeah. Guys.
I'm already doing it, me.
We're already following each other.
Just saying.
Well, thanks again, Michelle, and good luck for that endless time you spend with your mother.
And tell her, tell her we said hi.
He's worried now. Yeah. Dane's worried.
I'm worried.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Michelle.
Pleasure.
You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste and myself, Howard Cohen. For more from Dane and myself, make sure you follow us on Instagram at DaneSnapTiste and at The Howard Cohen. Please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. If you have a question for Dane, make sure you send us a DM on Instagram at DBQEPodcast. And we could feature you in our next episode. Thanks for listening, guys. And remember, question everything.
Insanity Group.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.